Welcome to Story Smack. Hello, my name's A. Kovacs, audiobook narrator and founding partner at Empty Set Entertainment.
My name is Scott Sigler, author, and San Diego Comic-Con has completely kicked my ass. I'm cashed out.
And this is episode 22 of Story Smack, a podcast about stories and storytellers in the world of pop culture. And today, we have a guest here to talk about his favorite movie. Welcome to the lair, Rob Reed.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
I'm so excited that you're here.
Yeah, it's great. Rob is the founder of the Rhapsody Music Service and is the author of the sci-fi novel Year Zero and the upcoming novel After On. Yes?
Yep. No longer upcoming. It comes out today.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, that's right.
We set this up to drop today.
Very day. Yeah. We're recording this a little before, but you know, it's going to come out today.
So the day we're launching this is August 1st, 2017, mm-hmm. and the book is out from Delray Books. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk a little bit about the book, but first, you have picked your favorite movie to bring onto the cast to talk to us, and it's Danny Boyle's first movie, Shallow Grave.
Yeah, and I will say it may be a little bit of an overstatement to say favorite movie. Okay. I don't really quite have one. I wanted to pick a movie that folks may not know coming onto here. I always say Raiders of the Lost Ark. You've probably discussed that many times.
Not too much yet. We'll get to that next time.
But I have nothing new to say about Raiders of the Lost Ark that has not been said by other people.
I love the idea of you sharing, you know, this is a movie everybody should see, but nobody's heard of.
Nobody's heard of it. Everybody's heard of Slumdog Millionaire. Mm-hmm. Most people have heard of Trainspotting, his later work. This was his first movie, and it is extraordinary. I saw it in theaters when it came out, which was pretty random because it was probably on three screens for 9 seconds. And it blew my mind, and it stayed with me for years and years and years. And then I rewatched it, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, and it was every bit as brilliant as I remembered it, and I rewatched it for today's purposes, and it's even more brilliant
than I remembered.
It's so rare that a movie holds up so well as you change in your life, and I feel like I rewatched it too. I watched it in the theaters in Nashville. I was living in Nashville at the time, and I had the same experience that here it is 20 years later, and I still think new, great, intricate things. It really shows what Danny Boyle was going to become back in the day. Yes.
And the only explanation for the fact that I like it more and more and the fact that you like it more and more is that over time, we must have both become more evil.
I know.
Well, this is
not a movie about nice people.
This is a movie about the hidden evil inside many of us, probably not all of us, but certainly three of us, not the three of us here on this podcast, but the three characters.
Or is it?
Yeah.
So Shallow Grave stars Carrie Fox, a very young Ewan McGregor, and for you sci-fi fans out there, my favorite Doctor Who, Christopher Eccleston. He was the ninth Doctor.
Early Christopher Eccleston. He's phenomenal in this. Yes. And did we mention this was Danny Boyle's first feature film?
Mm-hmm.
I think
first,
we did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so this episode is about Shallow Grave. We're going to get into that movie in a second. But first, Rob, tell us a little bit about After On, which is out today.
Yes. It is out today. So because we're in audio, I'm going to actually start with the audiobook. The audiobook, I personally listen to a huge number of audiobooks. And when I pick them, this is the only media that I do this in, I pick them in part on the basis of length because I have an Audible account, like one of the platinum plans. And so every book costs the same amount. Mm-hmm. When I see a book that is 22 hours long, that's a 4 times a better value than a 5 hour long book. This is a long book. And the audiobook, I've got some fabulous cast members. I've got John Hodgman. I've got Felicia Day.
I've got
Patrick Rothfuss. I've got Tom Merritt. Mm-hmm. I've got Leah Laporte. I've got YouTuber Jesse Cox. And then I've got two fabulous voice talent who folks probably haven't heard of, but they do a lot of audiobook reading. So that's for you, those of you who like spoken word content. The book is the tale of a diabolical social media company that embodies everything that's wrong with social media, dialed up by, let's say, 25 or 30%. So it's kind of in the realm, it verges into satire, but it's definitely not the realm of farce. And it's set in present day, actually not present day, it's set in San Francisco 9 seconds from now.
9 seconds.
So whenever you start reading the book, it takes place 9 seconds hence. So it's incumbent on you to read it quickly, which is tough because it is 547 pages long, which is why it took me so long to write it. Mm-hmm. The company is called Flutter, P-H-L-U-T-T-R, and it actually made a cameo appearance in Year Zero, my last novel.
Okay.
And there are two characters in Year Zero that make appearances in this book. So it's absolutely the same universe. But it's a very, very independent book. It is in no way, shape, or form necessary to read Year Zero in order to approach this. And so what happens is a little bit of a spoiler, but you will literally see it coming 300 pages off. What happens is Flutter attains consciousness.
Okay.
Contrary to the interest of anybody who has anything to do with the company, contrary to the interest of anybody in the world, really. And then she takes on, she self-identifies as female. She takes on her character from that, which she is, which is a social network. So then rather than going all Skynet and trying to kill us all, she basically becomes a super empowered, hyper intelligent 14-year-old brat. Mm-hmm. And so a certain amount of hilarity ensues. And Year Zero is a very playful novel. There's a great sense of play at work here, but it's also a very, very serious look at issues that concern me a great deal. Super intelligence risk. Get very, very deep into that. Synthetic biology, promise and peril, get very deep into that. Quantum computing is a major topic. Nihilistic terrorism is a major topic. I spent a lot of time in the Middle East, so that's kind of, you know, I've been interested in that subject for longer than most.
And you cover, you got a great promotion going for the book. You're doing a podcast talking to content experts about these critical areas in the book.
Yes. And that launches today as well.
That's today. Where can people get that at?
I don't know. I can tell you one place. It's going to be, by the time we go live, it'll be up on iTunes and Stitcher and all the usual places where people find it. It is called the After On Podcast. People can definitely find it at my website, after-on.com.
Great.
There's a chance that we're going to get a big distribution partner. I'd put the odds at about 20%. So there may be another big fat place where you can find it, but you can definitely find it at after-on.com.
And you'll have links to that place.
And
they'll be in the show notes for this cast too.
Yeah, we should know by then.
We will know by August 1st. And what I did with that is I basically, there's so much science and technology in the book that I wanted to dive into it in greater depth than you really can in a novel without doing, you know, committing lousy storytelling. And so I interviewed 8 domain experts in the sciences and technologies and sociopolitical issues that the book explores. So for nihilistic terrorism, I talked to Sam Harris, who is one of the most prominent and controversial spokespeople, that implies that he's a PR person, you know, thinkers on this topic in American society today. For neuroscience and consciousness, a big topic. I talked to a UCSF neuroscientist named Adam Ghazali, who is doing amazing work that with video games that might cure dementia. He has 100 people working full-time in his lab at UCSF. Amazing guy. So people like that. And we have the first podcast will be about augmented reality. That's up today. Mm-hmm. And I interview the CEO of a company called Meta, which along with Microsoft, HoloLens is one of the two companies that's shipping a full AR suite at this point. Mm-hmm. And I personally think the Meta 2, which is Meta's current product, is far more advanced than the HoloLens. And we talk about that in the episode. So the podcast is out there to wrap the science and technology around it. The book is out there as of today. And thank you for letting me blather about that.
Sure.
But I'll say I read the, you had an excerpt, a 50-page excerpt. And for all that heaviness that you just talked about, which is totally there and totally true, it is a very accessible, playful, good, fun, I don't want to say easy read. It's not quite that the right thing, but it is.
It breezes along. Yeah.
It breezes along and it's very engaging and it's very easy to be like, sure, I can make another 20 minutes while I sit in my car and, you know, that kind of thing. And it's also all those heavy things too. And that's a remarkable combination, I think.
Yeah. There's just what makes it work, I think, is there is a huge amount of playfulness mixed in with the darkness and the seriousness. Mm-hmm. And there are these funny devices like, the story is partly told through Amazon reviews. There are 18 Amazon reviews, and that's kind of a fun thing because I personally find them very funny. There are excerpts from a second novel, a mysterious novel. Eventually, the author of the novel becomes evident, but a mysterious novel that if I ever finished it, I just wrote the excerpts, obviously, I'm pretty convinced it would be the single worst science fiction novel ever written.
It's delightful to read those cliches.
Beyond belief. And that's what Patrick Rothfuss reads in the audio.
Oh my God, that's great.
And he reads it with so much charisma and energy and humor. Like his excerpts are brilliant.
That's great. Yeah. That's great. Okay. So we're going to get here. We're going to get in Shallow Grave now. First, the synopsis. And it is: 3 friends test the limits of loyalty when they discover their roommate's dead body along with a suitcase full of cash.
So this is the moment in the podcast where I tell everybody that this is your spoiler alert. If you haven't seen Shallow Grave and you want to listen to this, trust me, you want to watch the movie first. Pause this. We'll wait. Mm-hmm. Go watch it.
We're not going anywhere.
Come while you're signing up on Amazon Prime to get this. Go ahead and get After On. Why not? And then come back and join the conversation. So tell us, why did you pick this movie?
I picked it because when I first saw it in theaters, it was, to me, I had had people explain deft storytelling in film to me before. Mm-hmm. I've never been much of a filmie. And I have a lot of friends that are very, very sophisticated about film. And I've had people tell me why this particular technique in Godfather is brilliant and that thing okay. in Lawrence of Arabia. This was the first time that I watched a movie and I picked up on what I thought was incredibly deft storytelling on my own. And it's this. He probably had a budget that allowed him to make a 92-minute movie. It's not a long movie. I think it's 92 minutes or thereabouts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what the normal Hollywood approach would be to spend 37 of those minutes creating this complicated storyline about who were the bad guys and how did they start zeroing in on these people and how did the police start figuring out it's them, et cetera, et cetera. And Danny Boyle, this occurred to me as I was watching the movie, did this brilliant thing, which he basically said, look, you're watching this. You can fill in the blanks. All you need to know is these are very bad people. And I'm going to show you how bad they are by you watching two horrible murders. Briefly, actually. But that will give you a sense. And you've seen enough of these movies. You can fill in the blanks. Fill in the blanks that you want. But guess what? The three roommates don't know who they are or why they're zeroing in. They just know that they're zeroing in. That's all you need to know.
Yes.
And so he was able to put every second of that movie into this intense relationship between these three people. Mm-hmm. And I was so blown away by the audacity of that, because film in the mid 90s, as much as film today, was just very on the nose and, you know,
very linear storytelling and
exactly.
show you everything.
And even the brilliant movies from that time frame, like Usual Suspects, came out similar time frame, brilliant movie, very, very plot heavy. Now it worked in that case, but it's like just the level of depth that they were able to get into these three people are so powerful. And then the characters are just so wicked. I'd say wicked rather than evil. You know, they're corrupt. Mm-hmm. They're not corrupt in the sense that they're, you know, running the post office in a developing country.
Their souls
taking
are withered,
bride.
Blackened things.
Yeah. But they're really generally highly productive members of society. We got a reporter, we got an accountant, we got a doctor. Mm-hmm. But they're all kind of wicked underneath, and they bring out the wickedness in one another. And just the beginning where they're interviewing those roommates and just being so cruel to them for the fun of
just
it.
For the fun
That's
of it.
Part of the thing that I think Danny Boyle did so well about showing us, instead of that expository 37 minutes, just showing us, like, you first meet them and you're like, oh, these are people I might know. I might see at the pub every now and then.
Fun to hang out
and
with.
In 2 minutes or 3 minutes, when they get into them, their relationship, and then especially during the interviews, you realize, I never have met anybody like this. And
so
I hope to never, ever meet. It's the same thing with the single white female. Like, it starts out fine, but for Shallow Grave, I honestly think that the opening scene, or the especially the interview with the roommates, that scene, and the just the frivolity of it. Like, I remember there's that one part where I think Ewan McGregor is riding a bicycle around him, making one of the interviewers making no sense, just ludicrous. And I own a piece of the world that you can't get to because I'm just that.
They're enjoying what they're doing. Is there's three of them, and it's a flat with four rooms, and they're renting out the fourth room, and they are lording it over the fact that they have this incredibly desirable thing.
Awesome.
And they can
flat.
They can do anything they want to the people who come in, because the people are so desperate to get in there.
Which
and
is
they
just
do,
so...
It's shitty. They're just shitty.
It's just so ugly.
And
it is a reflection of the last scene of them together at the end of the movie. But instead of them being on top of the world and thinking they own everything, things have changed quite a bit at the end, where they are their essential, awful selves.
Well, they're
in
a zero-sum competition with each other.
Yeah.
They kind of regain control in a sense. It's up to the three of them at the very end. It's up to the three of them, but they have decided they're in a zero-sum struggle with each other, and friendship, fuck that. Mm-hmm. One of us is going to get all the money.
And we don't know. Clearly, they're not very good friends to start with in the beginning of this. They're all hanging out together, enjoying ridiculing people.
Yeah.
But this screenplay was written by John Hodge, who also wrote Trainspotting. And
Not John Hodge Men.
No, yeah. John Hodge. And A Life Less Ordinary. Both of those movies, of course, directed by Danny Boyle. I thought the part I enjoyed the most about this movie was the script. The Shallow Grave script is tight. It moves really well. Rob, I was wondering your thoughts on how much of the movie's effectiveness is Boyle's directorial, how much is the cast, who's very good at this, how much is a screenplay? If you were to, like, break down, is that an even breakdown, or is one thing elevated above the others?
Such an elegant It is such an elegant interchange. I mean, the performances are mind blowing. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever seen Carrie Fox in anything else, but in this movie, I thought and continue to think she's one of the sexiest women who ever lived. Mm-hmm. And she's a very pretty woman, but that sort of toxic sexiness, femme fatale thing, she just throws that out with the subtlest cues. I mean, one thing that struck me at the very, very end when she literally digs the knife in deeper, on Ewan McGregor, in order to make sure that she gets out of there alive or gets out of there with the money. Mm-hmm. She has what looks like a moment, a twinge of conscience.
She does.
And then as she starts dragging the suitcase, this smile busts across her face for about an eighth of a second. And you're like, oh my God, she's enjoying even this. Uh-huh. Yeah. So the acting is absolutely flawless. And I could point to 100 moments like that in this film. So acting is flawless. The script, like you said, it is so tight. Mm-hmm. It is so parsimonious. That's where these ingenious decisions are made about, you know, we've got 92 minutes. Let's focus on the one thing that is going to be this movie's superpower, which is this intense relationship. So it's flawless. Mm-hmm. And then the directing, it's like, God, that just the ominousness, you know, and that it's a big, beautiful apartment. By the way, I want to pay rent in Edinburgh in 1994.
Okay? Indeed.
Holy crap, that you can afford on a reporter's salary.
It's great.
But
yeah.
Despite the fact that it's pretty glorious, there's just always this ominous feeling. Like there's the shots were beautifully set. I just say it's a three-way tie. It's amazing.
Three-way tie. Hey, do you have any thoughts on it?
I will say that a lot of the ominousness for me is the brilliant, brilliant score. The score or the sound editing anyway is so carefully done. And for me, one of the most powerful pieces of this movie is the snippets of, there's a short, terribly intense handful of scenes that are terribly violent. The murders are terribly violent. The end of the movie with the stabbing and the killing and all that is terribly violent, but it's sort of short bursts of that.
Very short.
And then you realize after a while, the psychological horror and the psychological violence, that's the thing that just kicks my butt when I watch it, because you realize, you know, you can turn away. True Romance is a similar movie to this, where you think like, oh, I'm doing fine. And then you see something terribly violent and bloody and you're like, oh, I understand. Or Wild at Heart.
Yeah.
And then you realize after a while, like after an hour in or so, you realize, no, I'm not. I'm really unsettled, but it isn't the blood. It's these
watching
terrible
it to these people.
People.
Yeah.
And they, of course, the roommates, very short synopsis here, that the roommates pick a fourth roommate, Hugo. Hugo comes in.
And he's even more evil than they are. He hides it from them, but you the viewer, are made aware that he is twice as evil as the three of them combined.
Right.
And but they have no idea. They think he's the relatively nice one.
They think they're badasses. And then they meet an actual he's a badass who snows them over completely and they fall for it.
And wakes up the next day dead. He ODs in like the first or second night in his flat. And then they root through his room because they're terrible people.
They're horrible people.
Yeah.
And come across a huge suitcase full of money and are like, okay, well,
I like how Ewan McGregor started in the closet, because I know that character was thinking, maybe some of his clothes fit me.
Yeah. And he's rooting. He does like the rooting instantly through the drawers and whatever. And then there's a moment where Carrie Fox comes in and he's rooting through Hugo's drawers. And I totally agree with you, looking for like a great belt or something. Like, he's totally there for a selfish reason. And she's like, don't do that. I'm paraphrasing, but like, don't do this. This is a dead man's stuff. This is disrespectful, which is rich coming from her. And he literally turns around and he has drug paraphernalia in his hands. And he's like, this is a story. And she's like,
because he's a journalist.
Yeah. It's not every day. It's not a story.
It's not a story. It's, you're just,
it's a corpse.
An asshole.
It's a corpse.
That's
not
it.
A
that's
story,
the line.
It's a corpse.
It's not a, Yeah.
So they get done. Then they decide they want to keep the money, which means they must dispose of the body. Hence the name of the movie Shallow Grave, which of course factors in heavily as the movie goes on. And then we get some wonderful scenes where they draw straws. So he has to cut the body up and Christopher Eccleston draws the shortest straw. And he starts to go through changes immediately. And
right. Really, I think it breaks his psyche.
His character kind of carries the movie, right? Carrie Fox is great. And McGregor is such a bastard, self-impressed bastard, but Eccleston changes badly through the whole movie.
Yeah, he seemed like the only one with any moral center at the beginning. And maybe a little bit, because he was kind of the nerdier one.
And the shyer one.
Yeah, the shyer one.
They did a good job of hiding his, Danny Boyle did a good job of kind of hiding his size a little bit, because he's, you know, he's the chartered accountant, and he's very simple and very boring. And then by the end of the movie, when he's killed two people and disposed of three bodies,
right,
he's looming over everyone. Very tall, with very a lot powerful. Of long coats, very powerful. Yeah. And Ewan McGregor just withers in his presence. Like, he won't even do anything.
Well, and psychologically, they're the reverse at the beginning. Like, psychologically, McGregor was the big kid, like the mean, the kind of the bully. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, psychologically, the big kid and the one who called the shots, and it does totally flip. And seeing Ewan McGregor scared shitless of Doctor Who.
Yeah, it's great.
Pretty damn powerful.
It is so powerful also that they, there's a moment where you, and I don't mean to say sort of I am taken out of the story, but there's a moment where you realize, like, sure, I have no idea how this would work in my mind, but I sort of feel like what is happening to Christopher Eccleston is pretty damn close. Like he is, you can almost sort of see in his actions, his mind breaking piece by piece, and he's never coming back.
And for those who haven't seen it and are just okay with the spoilage, this is worth pointing out. What they decide to do is they need to cut off his feet and his hands because they have a notion the fingerprints are identifying. Maybe they and maybe toe prints as well. And then they need to shatter his dentistry.
Yeah.
And so what needs to be done is the hands and feet have to be cut off, and then the face has to be smashed in with a hammer. Mm-hmm. And that's you can imagine how hard that is. And I give Danny Boyle props. That could have been a gratuitously gory scene. You just see flashes of it. You know what he's doing.
It's a lot of silhouette work.
It doesn't. It doesn't have to be like rubbed in your face. And so the only moments of violence are, you know, when the bad guys are zeroing in and they're killing a couple of people. And then there's also the brawl, you know, when the bad guys break into the apartment. And what was interesting to me about that, and I don't know if this was deliberate or I'm just like playing shrink here, but it's kind of like Danny Boyle was saying, you know, the violence is psychological. You know, something awful being done to a dead body is interesting only to the extent that it changes Eccleston's character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we don't need to show you that in gory detail. But these two people dying these horrible deaths, and the one guy, God, when they drown the guy in the tub and it's red, so you know they've been cutting him before, they don't show them cutting
don't
it.
Have to
they
show
don't
it.
Need
yeah.
to. Mm-hmm. They drown him. And then to me, almost the most chilling moment of that scene is the two guys go out and the guy who actually committed the murder just sort of giggles.
Yeah.
And you're just thinking, you know, oh God, you know, these are tough guys doing a tough job. They probably hate this aspect. They probably feel some remorse.
Like giggling at the dumb guy he just killed.
Oh my God.
And we never learn those guys' names.
Nope.
Yeah.
There's never, they just,
we don't know where the money came from.
Don't know where the money came from. So it starts out as a fantasy. You know, it's like Three's Company meets Alfred Hitchcock, right?
Boyle calls it a comedy, a black comedy.
A black comedy. Yeah. There's a ton of humor in it. But then, and then they find this big suitcase full of money and everything's going to be great. And then they try to rationalize where they keep it. Then at 30 minutes, it starts to get really dark. And one thing that jumped out at me watching this now is at 44 minutes, we get Danny Boyle and Ewan McGregor and a crawling baby, which then...
Christopher Eccleston.
There's just the crawling baby, the Trainspotting, Trainspotting.
Sure. Oh.
So you can see the hints of one of the more famous scenes from Trainspotting in this too.
Interesting.
And it's a little disturbing. 52 minutes in, our lovely trio of people, they get their comeuppance as the bad guys arrive.
Yep.
And like you said, it's
pour through the door. Like that was such a, even though you kind of thought it might be coming, you kind of, at that point I figured they'd charm their way in or whatever. Just explode through
the
door.
Or have the talk, like I'll tell you what we're going to do and we're going to be all, you know, British and evil or Scottish and evil.
Or Pulp Fiction about it. I mean, they could have gone Pulp Fiction. Pulp Fiction was an absolutely ingenious movie. They could have done that and it could have worked, but it was just this explosion.
There's no words. Yeah. They don't even say anything. They don't even ask for anything. And then as they're whacking Ewan McGregor's shins with a crowbar.
Ouch. Well, he's got the plastic bag on his head.
Sucking
in air and screaming
then
and
he says, it's in the loft. And the bad guys have never said a word.
Right.
It's really cool. They don't have to ask for anything.
Well, and you think like that's such a deft, either a combination of the writer and the director or the director. It's such a deft move because the thing that lets the three of us sitting on the outside of the movie feel like our heroes are probably terrible, but might be good, but are almost assured, but might be good, is that they are so, they have so much levity about their evilness.
Mm-hmm.
And they think they always have the upper hand. They think they can talk their way out of anything because they're an accountant and a doctor.
They're smarter than everybody else.
And then the people who they would have pissed all over as not that smart at all completely dismantle them because they don't give a fuck. Yeah, you know, they're like, it is on and you will lose.
We get to 1 hour in. My favorite scene in the movie is Christopher Eccleston eventually moves into the attic and kind of is like golem, like crawling around up there. And then he starts to drill holes in the floor to watch
his precious.
With his precious. It's about it is. He's drilling holes in the floor to keep an eye on his roommates that he doesn't trust. And then finally, McGregor's getting ready to go up into the attic to talk. This is after he's killed the two bad guys and disposed of the bodies. So McGregor finally gets up the sand to go up there, and we pan up from the ladder where he's going in, and we go into the attic, and it's a pitch black attic, except for all the holes they've drilled into the floor. Now there are all these spider webby beams of light.
Yeah, it's a beautiful shot.
And Boyle's like, he's basically, Eccleston's become this spider. Here's his spider web, and he crawls around up there, and it's just this awesome panning shot, and it's really neat.
Yeah.
I like that one. And then we start to get into where my linear storytelling nature, I'm like, how the fuck did the cops know? You know? And I'm like, and as you mentioned, like Boyle doesn't bother with that.
No,
he doesn't bother with that.
And I also think that Boyle is trusting that we've seen a bunch of movies where
the
cops always assume everyone in the house is a suspect until they're proven not to be a suspect. It's always the most likely thing, right? Occam's Razor says these roommates have no more than they're saying. So I think there's a part of that where you sort of and of course it also makes sense that eventually Ewan McGregor's character has to cover the crime scene, you know, like that sort of thing.
As
that's
a reporter,
exactly how a normal crime movie would work.
Yeah.
We have reporters, we have guilty people, you know, it sort of works that way, but Boyle doesn't have to tell you to show you.
And the interplay between the two cops, they are frightening.
Great.
Like
They're
if
great.
They were, if you were a bad guy and they were on to you, this is sort of ice cold, this Arctic politeness.
Arctic politeness.
Utterly Arctic. And then every now and then he'd be like, oh, Junior Inspector is brilliant. Whatever his name was. I'm sure he'll make the grade.
It's,
you know, just sort of like things that you can imagine being sent in sort of like a offhand way they say, the cops say in these very precise tones.
Yes.
And there's one time when the junior inspector repeats what his boss said in just such a menacing way. He's like, I didn't mean, it was something like, I wasn't speaking metaphorically. And then he pipes up, he wasn't speaking metaphorically or whatever it was.
They stole the show at the end. I didn't look up who the gentleman was playing the primary detective, but just that dead stare and that little smile.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, I know you did it. You know, I'm going to get you. It's only a matter of time.
And I believe they're a little Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, right? I think they're weird. If this is going to be this dark and still a comedy, that is the sort of comic relief you need. I'm smarter than you. That sort of thing, I think. I will say, you mentioned one of your favorite scenes in the movie, which is so beautifully done. I find very hard to forget when they're disposing of the limbs and
the incinerator.
She brings
him in a bag
to the incinerator into the hospital, where she has taken an oath to do no harm. And just the look and just the casualness with which
she flings it.
Yeah. And just never looks at it again. Like flings it to the side, doesn't look back. It's so callous and so, so cold. And you're I don't think, if you actually did take an oath to do less or to do no harm, not sure you're going to be able to handle this long term.
But I think Carrie would have said, we didn't kill anybody.
Yeah.
OD'd. He was dead. Giving the money to the police or whoever would have done nothing to make his death easier or his life easier. I'm just throwing away the trash, is what she would say. And we all know intuitively there's something terribly wrong with that logic. But that's what she would say.
Yeah. And that's a good point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then an hour and 14 minutes in, we're getting the bad guys are taking their toll. And then hour and 23 minutes, like you said, it's a 90-minute film. The last 7 minutes where shit just falls apart, where they all think they're smarter than each other.
Yeah.
And yet they're all being played. A is playing B against C. B is playing C against A.
It's rock, paper, scissors.
It's the very most awful version of rock, paper, scissors.
And the interesting thing that I hadn't really thought until the beginning of our conversation is at that moment, kind of come out on top. You know, the bad guys are dead.
Yep.
The cops can suspect all they want, but the hands and feet and dentistry is gone. They've got what they fell into, which is this pile of money and just the three of them. And now nobody's after them. And so everything is now in their power. And that vileness on the inside, where every one of them has independently come to the conclusion, prisoner's dilemma, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, A, it's zero sum, but also prisoner's dilemma, where it's like, maybe each of them, there was a little bit of good in each of the characters. Mm-hmm. And maybe that good could have come together in a yay team way if it weren't for the fact that, as in The Prisoner's Dilemma, they all had such deep and well-founded suspicions of one another.
Right.
And so if you asked any one of those characters, why did you do that diabolical thing to your two friends at the end of this whole vignette, each one of them would have said, well, they would have done it to me. Right. And they would have been right.
Yeah.
And they'll get in first.
It's just so interesting. The other thing, I'm remembering another reason why this movie resonated with me so much. I had been living in Cairo, Egypt, about a few years before I saw it. I was a Fulbright scholar, and it was under Mubarak, and it was a police state. And there was some bad stuff that was just starting to happen, and it really kicked in after I left. And so a couple of people that I used to spend time with got assassinated, literally. They were members of the secular opposition and the Muslim Brotherhood. Well, not the brothers, but a more violent arm killed them. And there was always this sort of palpable dread under Mubarak. And I also went to Saddam's Iraq. I went to Iraq under Saddam.
Okay.
And so when they were interviewing, I'd totally forgotten this, when they were interviewing the roommates, I just thought, like, imagine these three people as interrogators in a police state. Imagine the
which like, is goofy as, and fun, and they're still gonna screw
oh no,
you.
But like as torturers. I mean, because like that was an ever-present part of not hopefully not most people's experience, but you know, plausible fears that all of my Egyptian friends had is you could end up in the hands of torturers, and certainly when I went to Iraq, I mean that was you could chew the fear. It was so palpable, and so I was thinking, as I was watching the movie, just imagine these guys working for Saddam as interrogators with unlimited cruelty at their disposal. Yes. And then the two cops, I was like, oh my God, if these two cops were Egyptian cops and you were talking to them in this thing, and even if you'd done nothing, you're kind of powerless when the cops pull you
and
over.
Doing nothing in that situation doesn't really matter.
Right. It doesn't. And it was, maybe that was part of what made it so like palpable to me.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I do find that, so I had mentioned it a little earlier, but now we've talked about some of the guts of the movie and that scene in the beginning, you, as, or at least me, and I believe the two of you as normal humans and humans who have a morality, whatever that morality is, trending towards good. You sit and you watch them be so cruel to the interviewees and kind of like, okay, like I'm learning things about these characters. It's fine. Even though these people exist, or so in my head, so you think like, I know sort of bullies, this is fine. This is going to turn, we'll learn more about them and hopefully they will. And you instinctively, or at least I instinctively feel like they will persevere and have a revelation and become better people. That's how you feel, because every story you want to end well, you hope that they get their comeuppance, learn, and move on. Mm-hmm. And then it just goes absolutely south in the entire different direction. And then they're back at they have a moment where they could walk away and win. Mm-hmm. If
and the definition of the greatest possible definition of winning that was sparkling in front of them in the middle of the movie. Like, oh my God, we're home free. Mm-hmm. Three of us
we
together,
got away with it.
Got the money, done.
Especially when the bodies are found and the cops, we're sitting here, hear a cop say, we'll try to figure out who they are, but we can't figure out who these people are. And you're like, and that's insider information for Ewan McGregor. Like, you've got it. That's it. It's done. You guys won. It's over. You did everything correctly.
And yet
except
they can't.
Except hitting the grave shell
and
deep
it's
enough.
It's zero sum.
Yeah, it's zero sum.
Yeah.
So I think we might be, I think we all would recommend, if you guys are listening and you have enjoyed this conversation, you will enjoy the movie that much more if you haven't seen it.
Yeah.
Share with your friends. Anything else for you guys?
We talk about where people can find us at the end of the episode. Where can people find you at and social media, et cetera?
At Twitter, at @Rob_Reed.
Okay.
And the other place that I'm pretty present is on Medium. Mm-hmm. And on Medium, it's medium.com/@Rob Reed. And what I need to note is my last name is spelled R-E-I-D.
Okay.
So @ROBREID on Medium and @Rob_Reed on Twitter.
Great.
So we hope you have enjoyed episode 22 of Story Smack. What movie, TV show, book, or other story would you like us to talk about? Please email your ideas to info@emptyset. And as Scott said, you can find the two of us also online. Scott is @ScottSigler on Twitter and Instagram. His Facebook page is facebook.com/ScottSigler. I am @arealgirl on Twitter and @a.real.girl on Instagram. And you can find this podcast online at scottsigler.com/storysmack. We would love to see your comments there.
And thank you for being on the show, Rob.
Absolutely.
I'm excited your book comes out today. It's kind of
weird. Congratulations. Happy book birthday.
Thank you.
We lucked out. You're the first media guest to have on the show. It's been you and my two nephews. That's all we've had on the show so far.
I do have one thing to add. Because this is going up on August 1st, anybody who is in the Bay Area, tonight, the book launch will be at Booksmith on Haight Street.
Okay.
At 7:30. A little reading, a little bit of wine, you know, handful of friends.
Love that.
Everybody who's listening, anybody who's listening in the Bay Area is more than welcome.
All you San Francisco junkies, go check that out. And until next week,
we will talk to you all real soon.